So we're picking up the story on capital structure, and I want to remind you of where we got to at the end of the last lecture. We're looking at this graph, which describes what I call the traditional view of capital structure. So perhaps the first thing I should say is, and you might want to write this down, the traditional view is not the same view as the Modigliani-Miller, or M&M view, that we're going to go on and talk about in the next slide. So this is a rival theory. That's why I call it the traditional view of capital structure. First thing I want to do, as I did yesterday, is draw your attention to the variables that are plotted along the two axes. In this diagram, the horizontal axis is the gearing ratio. That's the ratio of debt to equity in the firm's capital structure. And can we be clear, please, that it's market value of debt divided by market value of equity. We always use market values in finance. Up the vertical axis is cost of capital. We have three costs of capital to think about now. The diagram currently shows us two: cost of debt and cost of equity. Let's look carefully at the shape of these two graphs. The cost of debt capital is flat. It's a constant. It's the risk-free rate. And if you didn't write it down yesterday, make sure you've annotated the vertical axis, write RF here to remind you that the cost of debt in our model is the risk-free rate because we assume the debt is riskless. When you go on and do finance 2, either next year or in your final year, you will generalise this model. You'll allow the debt to become risky. But that's a step too far for us. So the cost of debt graph is a horizontal line, and the height of that line is the risk-free rate. Now I want you to look at the cost of equity graph. Clearly, it rises from left to right as we replace, and this is very important, as we replace more and more equity with debt in the firm's capital structure. This is a substitution effect. We're not adding the debt onto the existing equity. We're replacing more and more equity with debt in the firm's capital structure. As we do that, the cost of equity increases. We saw in the simple numerical example in yesterday's lecture, we compared two firms with identical operating activities, identical operations. So in terms of their assets and what they do with those assets, those two firms were indistinguishable. The only thing to tell these two firms apart was the capital structure. The first firm, firm A, was 100% equity financed. The second firm was part equity, part debt financed. Actually, the numbers I chose imply that the debt to equity ratio was 1:1. So debt and equity each account for 50% of firm B. You can work through the details yourself if you look back at the example. What we saw in that simple numerical example was the risk that the shareholders in the firm with debt, the risk they were exposed to was greater, so we know from the cost of capital lecture that the shareholders of that firm will demand a higher rate of return. And so it is. So the little numerical example from yesterday's lecture helps us to understand why the cost of equity increases as we replace more and more equity with debt in the firm's capital structure. What I want you to notice, though, is that in the traditional view of capital structure, the rate of increase itself increases. The graph is not a straight line. The graph is a curve that bends upwards. That's important. That's important in order to understand why the corresponding graph for the weighted average cost of capital is U-shaped. Now let's think about it. Finally, we've got the visualizer back working, so hopefully this is more visible.
The box, as yesterday, represents the firm. The size of the box represents the market value of the firm, the market value of the firm's assets. And in general, those assets are financed by a mixture of debt and equity. As we read from left to right in the graph on the printed slide, what's happening is that this dividing line is shifting to the right. More and more equity is being replaced by debt. When we start at the vertical axis in the graph, there is no debt. So all of the box is equity. As we start to move to the right, we start to replace some of the equity with debt. The further to the right in the graph, the more debt has replaced equity. Look at the consequence for the cost of equity from doing that. So let's remind ourselves, what does the WACC, the weighted average cost of capital, look like? You need to know this formula. We met it in the cost of capital lecture. As the name implies, the weighted average cost of capital is an average. It's a weighted average, in this case, of two costs of capital. A cost of debt capital and a cost of equity capital. And the weights, that's the coefficients in the expression for the weighted average cost of capital, the weights reflect what proportion of the company's overall financing, that's D plus E, what proportion of that is debt? That's that coefficient. What proportion of the company's overall financing, D plus E, is equity? That's that coefficient. Now, think about it. As we move our eye further and further to the right, what's happening is we're replacing equity, more and more equity, with more and more debt. To begin with, the cost of equity doesn't change by much. So what we're doing is we're replacing some of the equity in the firm, and that has a higher cost of capital. You can see that. That has a higher cost of capital than the corresponding debt. To begin with, as we start to replace some of the equity with debt, we're replacing something with a high cost of capital with something with a lower cost of capital. So that's bound to bring the weighted average down. And that's why the WACC graph, to begin with, falls. The cost of equity capital is not changing by very much. You could, if you like, to begin with at least, think of it as a constant. It's not a constant, but it doesn't change by very much to begin with. So what you're doing is replacing some of the equity that has a high cost of capital with debt that has a lower cost of capital. And that's bound to bring down the weighted average. What is it that causes the WACC graph to turn round? Answer, the cost of equity capital doesn't stay flat. As you replace more and more equity with debt, the cost of equity itself is increasing. That introduces a break. That acts as a break on the rate of descent of the weighted average. If you push it far enough, yeah, you're replacing equity, you're replacing some of the equity with debt. That debt has a lower cost of capital than the equity, yes, but the equity that remains doesn't have a constant cost of capital. The cost of capital of the equity that's remaining is getting bigger and bigger. And that's what's starting to push up the weighted average. And if you replace enough equity by debt, the cost of equity, the cost of the remaining equity capital, is getting so high that it more than offsets the fact that you're replacing some of the equity with debt and debt has a lower cost of capital. That's what's causing the WACC graph to turn round. And it's important for us that the WACC graph turns round, because what the U-shaped graph is telling us is there's a minimum. There is a capital structure, there is a ratio of debt to equity that minimises the weighted average cost of capital. But we saw in yesterday's lecture that there's an inverse relationship between cost of capital and market value. When you're looking at weighted average cost of capital, the market value you're talking about is the market value of the firm as a whole. That's the market value of its assets. So if you found a particular gearing ratio that minimises the weighted average cost of capital, that same gearing ratio is maximising the market value of the firm's assets, and therefore maximising the value of the firm. And because the debt is assumed to be riskless, maximising the value of the firm's assets is the same thing as maximising the value of the firm's equity, because it's only the equity piece that changes. And maximising the market value of the firm's equity is what the senior managers are all about. That's their purpose in life. They are there to maximise shareholder wealth. So the message is, if the traditional view of capital structure is true, there is an optimal capital structure, there is an optimal ratio of debt to equity, and the senior managers owe it to the shareholders to find out what that is. They should aim for that particular debt to equity ratio over the long run in order to maximise shareholder wealth. That's the message. Keep that in the back of your head. That's the traditional view of capital structure. Now we're going to look at a rival theory. Modigliani-Miller model. Now that's such a mouthful, we call it M&M for short. So the M&M model of capital structure, it's not the same as the traditional view. It's a rival theory. And you need to know what it is. So we need to spend some time talking and learning about M&M. Look at the graph I've drawn. Look at the graph. What's different? What's the key difference between this graph and the previous graph? Just look at it for a moment. In both graphs, the cost of debt capital is flat. That's because in both views, we are assuming the debt is riskless. So again, the height of this graph is the risk-free rate. You might want to write that down. In both graphs, the cost of equity capital increases as you replace more and more equity with debt. So look at the little cartoon on the right-hand screen. As the dividing line moves further and further to the right, so you're replacing more and more equity with debt, so does the cost of equity increase. The difference is that now the increase, the rate of increase, is a constant. The cost of equity capital increases, but it doesn't speed up. It doesn't accelerate. It increases at a fixed rate, so the graph is a straight line. And it's not any old straight line. It's not any old slope that you fancy. It has to be off just the right slope to make the WACC graph flat. And one of the seminar questions next week asks you, what must the equation of this cost of equity graph be in order to ensure that the WACC graph is flat? In the M&M model, the WACC doesn't change. The weighted average cost of capital does not change with changes in gearing. It's not U-shaped. There isn't a minimum. There isn't an optimal capital structure. In the M&M model, capital structure is irrelevant. You can position yourself wherever you want along the horizontal axis. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change the weighted average cost of capital, and therefore it doesn't change the market value of the firm's assets. So don't waste any time looking for an optimal capital structure, because there isn't one. Now, so far, that sounds like a mathematical argument. All that sounds like is a mathematical puzzle. Work out the precise characteristics of the cost of equity capital graph in order to make the WACC graph flat. What I've not answered at all is, why should the WACC graph be flat in the first place? And that's the real insight of the M&M model. Because in the M&M perfect world, and I'll tell you shortly what the characteristics of that perfect world are, in the M&M perfect world, all that matters as far as the value of a company is concerned is its assets and what it does with those assets. It doesn't matter where did the money come from in the first place to buy those assets. In other words, the sources of the financing don't matter. In the M&M perfect world, it doesn't matter whether the firm is all equity financed or part debt, part equity financed. All that matters is, what does the company do with that financing? In other words, what assets does it buy, and what does it do with those assets, i.e., what capital projects does it invest in? It's the capital projects that are the source of the value of the company. It's the assets and what the company does with the assets that are the source of value for the company. Not where did the capital come from originally. That's the key insight. In other words, and you might want to write this down, in an M&M perfect world, all that matters as far as the value of a company is concerned is its capital investment policy. What its assets are and what it does with those assets. And can I remind you from the end of the project appraisal lecture, I said that the senior managers of the company are all about maximising shareholder value by identifying and investing in positive NPV projects. The positive NPV is there if and only if the company has some competitive advantage. There must be something about the assets of the firm and what the company does with those assets that enables it to steal a march on its competitors. So maybe the expertise of the people in the company who are using those assets, maybe that's what sets it apart from its competitors. Maybe the ideas that the company has have been patented and therefore protected for a period of time from competitors to enable the company to get ahead, to generate greater cash flows in the earlier years when the discounting kicks in less severely, because those early cash flows are closer to the present day and therefore are not discounted as heavily. Those are the sources of the positive NPV, and that's where the value of the company is coming from. And it has all to do with the assets of the company and what the company does with those assets. It has nothing to do with where did the company raise the finance from in the first place. At least, it has nothing to do with that in an M&M perfect world. So now we need to know, what does an M&M perfect world look like? What does an M&M perfect world look like? I'm not going to give you the full list of characteristics. I've got to keep something back from you. You have to wait till finance 2 to get the full story. But I'll give you enough details to be getting on with. So, in an M&M perfect world, there are no taxes. From time to time, I read answers in exam questions that slightly worry me. So it is, in fact, the case, on at least one occasion a couple of years ago, from the answer in the question, the student would appear to have understood me to mean, there are none of those black vehicles on four wheels that take people to airports. That's not what I meant when I said no taxis. I mean there's no tax man. The company does not pay any corporation tax on its income. In addition, the shareholders don't pay any personal taxes, either on their dividend income or on the capital gains they might make from selling on the shares for more than they purchased them from. So there are no taxes. There are no transactions costs. So there are no issue costs in particular with raising capital. Homogeneous expectations. And I know that whenever a student writes those two words in the answer to an exam question, they don't know what they're talking about. So let's not use that terminology that the academics use. Let's explain it in terms that we understand. In the M&M perfect world, everyone has the same information set, regardless of whether they're on the inside of the company or on the outside. So there's no private information in an M&M perfect world. Everyone has the same information set. The way that shows itself up is everyone agrees on the rates of return that the equity holders should demand, the debt holders should demand. Everyone agrees on how risky the equity is, and everyone agrees on how risky the debt is, but I need hardly say that last point because we're assuming the debt isn't risky. That's what homogeneous expectations mean. Everyone agrees on what the rates of return are to demand from the equity piece and the debt piece. And everyone agrees on how risky, whatever risk really means, and you have to wait till Finance 1 properly to understand that, everyone agrees on how risky the equity piece is and how risky the debt piece is. That's what homogeneous expectations mean. The homogeneity has to do with everyone in the story has the same set of beliefs. But I just want you to think in terms of it meaning everyone has the same information set. Whether they're a senior manager on the main board of the company, whether they are shareholders in the company, whether they are lenders to the company, or whether they are none of these, everyone has the same information set. So no taxes, no transactions costs, dare I say it, homogeneous expectations, i.e. everyone has the same information set. And the last feature, the financial markets are perfectly efficient. Perfectly efficient. So, the market value of the firm's equity is the correct value. There's no mispricing. The market value of the firm's debt is the correct value. There's no mispricing. Everyone has the same information set, and therefore the market has the full information set, and the market is perfectly efficient at impounding relevant new information in its prices. So everything is correct and is kept bang up to date as new information arrives. So those are the four key characteristics of the M&M perfect world. The graph on this slide is what the story looks like in the M&M perfect world. And the key point about the diagram is that the WACC graph is flat. The WACC does not change with the gearing ratio. You can spend your life trying different combinations of debt and equity. It won't have any effect on the WACC, and therefore it won't have any effect on the market value of the firm. So senior managers, you've got plenty to be getting on with, running this company, setting the strategy, maximising shareholder value. Don't spend 1 minute of your lives thinking about capital structure if we're in an M&M world, because it doesn't matter. In the jargon, capital structure is irrelevant. That's in an M&M perfect world. This model was put together and published in 1958. And again, you'll learn more about it and why it's so important in Finance 2. Why are we bothering to talk about a model that was first thought up in 1958? Well, I was alive, but only just. You weren't. A model that doesn't describe the real world. Why are we paying so much attention to it? The answer is because we think capital structure might matter in the real world. Why do we think it might matter? Because when we look at companies in the real world, we observe that they employ very different capital structures from one another. Some companies operate with very low gearing ratios. Other companies operate with relatively high gearing ratios. That suggests perhaps it matters. But it doesn't matter in an M&M perfect world. The real reason for introducing the M&M perfect world is then to go on and compare it with the real world to see which of the differences between the M&M perfect world and the real world matter and might be an explanation for why capital structure is important in the real world. In other words, I am setting up M&M's perfect world, the M&M model, I'm setting it up as a straw man that we're then going to knock down. We're going to start to take it apart. We want to see in what ways is it deficient. What are the key ways in which it's failing to describe the real world, in the hope that they are the clue to why capital structure does matter in the real world, in the hope then that managers of the companies can work out, can identify what should they be worrying about in order to get that holy grail of an optimum capital structure. That's the logic. M&M themselves revisited their model 5 years later. So now it's 1963 and I'm at primary school, and they've come up with what they called a correction. Correction. We didn't include corporation tax. Well, that was quite deliberate, but we recognise that missing out corporation tax is to miss out an important detail. So we'd now like to revisit our model. We're no longer in a perfect world. We're in a almost perfect world. There is one imperfection, one market imperfection. There are corporation taxes. Now, why might we want corporation taxes? Why might we want to consider this? Let's go back to that numerical example. Do you see from the numerical example that the fact that the company has to pay interest on debt, firm B that is, the fact that the firm has debt in its capital structure and therefore has to pay interest on that debt, can you see that the debt acts as a shield against the tax man? The key point is, and I've said this many times, that in the queue for cash handouts, the lenders are at the head of the queue. They're ahead of the tax man in the queue for cash handouts. So the first thing the company has to do is make the interest payments on its debt. It's only what's left that's taxable. So the interest payment is acting as a shield against the taxman. He can't tax us on all of our operating cash flow. He can only tax us on what's called our taxable income. That's the operating cash flow after we've made the interest payments on the debt. Look at the numbers in the table and convince yourself, it's not difficult, the taxable income is reduced by the amount of the interest payment. The next bit is what really matters. The reduction in the company's corporation tax bill, that's not equal to the interest payment, that's equal to the interest payment times the corporate tax rate. The company is paying less corporation tax because it has debt in its capital structure and first of all has to pay interest on that debt before it has to settle up with the taxman. The taxable income is reduced by the interest payment. The amount of tax that has to be paid is reduced by the product interest payment times corporate tax rate. In other words, there's a cash flow saving. There's a tax cash flow saving. Less money is handed over to the taxman thanks to the fact that the company has debt in its capital structure and first of all has to pay interest. In the jargon, and this is the language the taxman understands, interest payments on debt are corporate tax deductible. Deduct the interest payment first before you decide what is your taxable income. Your taxable income is reduced by the amount of the interest payment, so the amount of tax you pay is also reduced, not by the interest payment, but by the interest payment multiplied by the corporate tax rate. So that product is a cash flow that stays within the company. It doesn't end up in the hands of the taxman, who is a third party. It stays within the company. It adds to the value of the company. And this matters for the shareholders, because that cash flow saving belongs to the shareholders. It doesn't belong to the debt holders. They've already had their interest payment. The taxman can't get his grubby hands on it, because he can only levy tax on the operating cash flow net of the interest payment. The corporation tax payment is reduced. Some of that cash flow stays within the company and belongs to the shareholders. And there's the saving. Now, just as we did in yesterday's lecture, to keep the math simple, we assume that all of these cash flows form perpetuities. In other words, they are repeated year in, year out. The size of the cash flows doesn't change. So the tax cash flow saving is itself a perpetuity. The size of the tax cash flow saving is given by the product, interest payment on debt times corporate tax rate. You know how to calculate the present value of a perpetuity. You just grab hold of any one of the cash flows, because they're all the same, and you divide by the appropriate discount rate. Here the cash flows we're talking about are derived from the interest payments. So the correct discount rate to use is the cost of debt capital. Now wait a minute. The interest payments themselves are simply obtained by taking the amount of debt and multiplying by the cost of debt. So this product is the size of the interest payment. Do you see that the cost of debt capital cancels upstairs and downstairs? The present value of this infinite stream of tax cash flow savings is given by that simple expression. That's the uplift in the value of the firm today. That's additional value that stays within the firm, belongs to the shareholders, because the taxman can't get his hands on it, thanks to interest payments on debt being corporate tax deductible. So now when we revisit the graph, if I go back one slide for a moment, that's what the graph looked like in terms of cost of capital. It's now easier to work with value of the firm rather than cost of capital. You see why? Because I want the graphs to be nice and simple. So let's jump forward one slide to the graph. And before we do anything else, let's check what's along the axes. Because I've switched the axes now. I've changed the variable to suit my purpose. The story is the same, but it's easier to represent with a different graph. So whereas in the earlier graphs, the horizontal axis was the gearing ratio, it isn't anymore. In this diagram, the horizontal axis is the market value of the firm's debt. The market value. Now, in our model, because the debt is riskless, there isn't any difference between market value and book value. But when you go on into finance two, and the debt piece is also risky, you have to be absolutely clear that it's market value you're working with. Up the vertical axis is no longer a cost of capital, it's a market value. So whereas previously we were drawing graphs that involved the weighted average cost of capital, now we're drawing the other way of thinking about it. Weighted average cost of capital is intimately and inversely related to the market value of the firm. And it suits my purpose now to think in terms of market value of the firm. In the M&M perfect world, the WACC graph was flat, and so is the graph of the market value of the firm. Now ask yourself, why is that? Here's the answer. We're keeping things nice and simple, so cash flows are the same size each year indefinitely into the future. In other words, whatever cash flow we're talking about, it forms a perpetuity. When we're looking at the assets of the firm, and we are when we're talking about the WACC, because the WACC is the rate of return to require from investing in those assets. When we're looking at the assets, the cash flows we're talking about are the operating cash flows. The operating cash flows. And we are assuming, because M&M is assuming, that the capital investment policy of the firm is fixed. In other words, it has decided on what its assets are. It's bought them. It has decided on the capital investment projects it's going to invest in. So the cash flow from operations each year is fixed. So that number upstairs is the same each year. It's the cash flow from operations. That was the number at the very top of the table in the numerical example earlier on in yesterday's lecture. Downstairs is the discount rate. But remember, it's a perpetuity. So the present value, the market value of a perpetuity, just grab hold of any one of the cash flows and divide it by the corresponding discount rate. So upstairs is the operating cash flow. That's not changing from year to year because the capital investment policy is not changing, we assume. So that's fixed. And downstairs is the weighted average cost of capital. Because the weighted average cost of capital is the correct discount rate to use when you are pricing, i.e. when you are valuing the assets of the firm. So the equation you're left with is the market value today of the firm's assets equals the operating cash flow in any one year divided by the weighted average cost of capital. The operating cash flow is not changing because the capital investment policy is fixed. The WACC is not changing because the earlier diagram told us that in an M&M perfect world, the WACC doesn't change. Therefore, the market value of the firm on the left-hand side doesn't change. And that's why the graph is once again a horizontal line. It's flat because the investment, the capital investment policy is fixed, and because the WACC is fixed. When we move into the revision, the correction to the M&M perfect world, when we introduce corporation taxes, we learn that there's an uplift in the market value of the firm. There's extra to be had. And that extra is to be had at the expense of the taxman. That extra is as a result of the tax shield effect of debt. You know how big that is. It's given by the product corporate tax rate, which is fixed. We're going to assume 30%. You know that it's 28% currently for large companies, and you know that come the beginning of April, it's going to be 27%. We'll just take it as 30% because it's a nice round number. It doesn't change. The tax shield, the uplift we saw on the previous slide, is given by the product corporate tax rate times the market value of debt. Corporate tax rate is fixed. Market value of debt is increasing from left to right. So the size of the uplift increases linearly with the market value of debt. Now perhaps you can see why I changed the horizontal axis and indeed the vertical axis. It was in order to get a straight line as my graph. If I'd felt particularly masochistic, I could have kept the story in terms of cost to capital and gearing ratio. But the graphs would have been curves, not straight lines. I want a straight line because then I can see at a glance what's going on. So keep in your mind these two graphs. The flat graph describes the M&M perfect world, in which capital structure does not matter. The upward sloping straight line graph describes the M&M world in which there are corporation taxes. But that's the only form of market imperfection. In the M&M perfect world, there is no optimal capital structure. But there is in the revised M&M world. I hope you can see that the recommendation to come out of the revised model is have as much debt as you can possibly get. Because the greater the amount of debt in your capital structure, the greater is the uplift thanks to the kickback, the corporation tax kickback from the taxman, so have as much debt as you can have. So if that model is true, and we look at the capital structure of companies, we should find that there's very little equity. You have to have a certain amount of equity. You have to have at least two shareholders by the Articles of Association. But according to this, you should have as little equity as you can get away with. The rest of it should be debt. That's not what's observed in the real world. So M&M 1963, whilst a helpful development of their earlier idealistic model, still isn't the full story. So now I have to tell you about what is likely to happen in the real world as we move further and further to the right, as we're replacing more and more equity by debt. A number of things happen. Even if the interest payment, the interest rate on the debt, even if that weren't to change, as we have more and more debt in the capital structure, the amount of interest we have to pay must get bigger and bigger. Suppose the interest payment on all of the debt was fixed at 10%. Well, the more and more debt we have, the more and more we have to pay in total, in interest, because it's 10% of this debt. As we have more and more debt in the capital structure, that's more and more cash flow that the company has to be able to find. Easy in the good times, perhaps, but not so easy in the bad times. So, one consideration is, as we have more and more debt in the capital structure, the possibility that the company might not be able fully to service its debt, that's just a fancy way of saying meet the interest payments in full and on time year after year, the possibility, the probability that the company might not be able to do that gets higher. That causes the managers to have to think harder, and work harder. That causes the senior managers to have to encourage the employees to sweat the firm's assets harder in order to generate more cash flow to make sure whatever else happens, the company doesn't default on its interest payments. Because miss an interest payment and you could be finished, wound up in the courts. But it's not just the senior managers that are alert to this possibility. It's getting harder. The company's having to pedal faster to keep maintaining the interest payments. It's not just the senior managers that are aware of this. So are the lenders. And as the company attempts to take more and more debt into its capital structure, what it finds is, the interest rate on the new bits of debt has got higher. We're seen as a less good credit risk. So we have to pay higher interest rates on these additional tranches of debt. And that's a double whammy. Not only is there more debt on which to pay interest, but the rate at which we have to pay interest on this new debt is higher. So we get hit twice. And that makes it even harder for the company to meet its interest payments. So the company has to spend increasing amounts of time and effort and money. Might have to hire some advisors, making sure, monitoring its activities, and making sure that it can continue to meet its interest payments. That's a cost. Time and money and effort spent doing that detracts from the value of the company. And we call that the cost of financial distress. It's time, effort, and money spent avoiding bankruptcy. Not dealing with bankruptcy, taking preventative measures to make sure we can continue to meet these ever-increasing interest payments. But there's another consideration, and that's known as agency effects. As the debt in the capital structure gets bigger and bigger, running the company becomes riskier. There is more risk that the company might default. And the senior managers are aware of that. And sometimes what can happen is the senior managers decide, this new project is high risk. If it comes off, we're away to the races. We're going to get a big fat bonus. It might not come off. But frankly, the way things are going, we might be out of a job anyway. So to hell with it, let's take the risk. That's not necessarily in the company's best interests. They might decide on one last big stand to get us out of this difficult set of conditions. If it works, everybody's laughing. So what about the possibility that it doesn't work? The scenario then almost certainly leads to the end of the company. So there's an agency effect. The managers stop behaving in ways that are in the best interests of the shareholders. And they start to do what's in their best interests. Now the shareholders are alert to this. And that's why there are non-executive directors on the boards of companies. They're there to monitor the decision making of the senior managers. They're there, and they have to be paid. They're there to ensure, as best they can, that the decisions that the senior managers make remain aligned with the best interests of the shareholders. It costs money to monitor the senior managers. That's an agency cost. The senior managers may be very strong personalities who nonetheless push through their plans, and their plans may prove to be disastrous. That's a cost. That could be the end of the company. The lenders alert to what's going on. They see how much debt is in the firm's capital structure. They understand only too well that the firm is having to pedal faster and faster to meet these increasing interest payments. The lenders start to apply restrictions to what the loans can be used to do. They're known as restrictive covenants. We'll lend you some more money. You'll pay a higher interest rate because we're a bit worried about your ability. You're not as good a credit risk. But we're also concerned that in these more straitened times you might take unnecessary risks. So we absolutely forbid you from using the money we're now going to lend you, we absolutely forbid you from investing in Project X or Project Y. Now, Project X might actually be a winning project, and the company misses out on it. So it misses out on that big positive NPV. That's a cost. That's an opportunity cost. So there are any number of effects, because now we're in these difficult times, there are any number of effects kicking in, costs of financial distress and agency costs, and they both act in the same way. They reduce the company's market value. So, we started with M&M's perfect world, where capital structure didn't matter. We introduced corporation taxes into the perfect world and came to the conclusion that the company should have as much debt in its capital structure as it can manage. And then finally, we introduced some real-world considerations, the costs involved in dealing with financial distress, and financial distress becomes ever more important as we have more and more debt in the capital structure, together with the costs involved in dealing with agency effects. And agency effects have to do with a gap opening up between what the senior managers do and what's in the best interest of the shareholders. They're no longer perfectly aligned. So the graph ends up looking like the following. Do you see what's important? Now it's an inverted U-shape. It's inverted because we're looking at value rather than cost of capital. But once again, there's an optimum point. Now it's a maximum. Because we're looking at value of the firm, not weighted average cost of capital, we find there's a maximum. So once again, we come to the conclusion there is an optimal capital structure. And the thought I want to leave you with for the real world is, how might managers decide what that optimum capital structure is for their firm? I'll leave you with two thoughts. The more profitable the company's activities are, year by year, consistently profitable, the higher the debt-to-equity ratio that company can support. Because the more profitable it is, the more surplus cash flows it will have on a year-by-year basis, so no worries about meeting the interest payments on the debt. So I would suggest to you that if you look at the capital structure of various firms in the real world, where you see a high gearing ratio, one of the things you should check is how profitable is that firm? How profitable has it been, say, in each of the last 5 years? You might find that that firm has been consistently profitable. That explains, in that firm's case, the high gearing ratio. Here's another consideration. You might want to look at the balance sheet of the firm, and in particular, the makeup of the fixed assets of the firm. To what extent are the fixed assets tangible, and to what extent are they intangible? This is a tangible asset because I just touched it. So buildings and equipment are tangible assets. People like you and me are intangible assets. And the intellectual property we have in our heads can very easily walk out the door with us when we give up our jobs and go work for someone else. Likewise, the value that's attached to the brand name. You see me do this, the letter M with my fingers. I want you to think market. Next week I want you to think Modigliani Miller. The chances are you probably think McDonald's because it's an easily recognisable brand name, a logo. That's very valuable. That's another example of intangible asset. I'd suggest to you that the companies that operate with high gearing ratios are probably companies with a high proportion of their assets in the form of tangible assets. Why? Because whenever the cash flows are starting to dry up and it's looking like we might be struggling to meet the interest payments, we could always sell some of those fixed assets to raise the cash flow necessary to continue to meet the interest payments. So I'll leave you with two thoughts. Companies operate with very different gearing ratios from one another. Are there patterns that you could uncover? Suggestion one, perhaps it's the highly profitable, consistently profitable firms that operate with high gearing ratios. Perhaps it's firms with large percentages of their assets in the form of tangible assets, e.g. heavy engineering firms that operate with high gearing ratios. Perhaps it's firms with large amounts of their assets in the form of intangible assets, e.g. big pharmaceutical companies, where a large part of the company's value resides in individual blockbuster drugs that are themselves the result of the intellectual property of the scientists who work with those firms. You might like to check that.